Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Philosophy for Our Time.
Facts are assertions.
From the Institute of Art and Ideas, we examine every aspect of contemporary thinking.
What is love? Is it real?
Is democracy illusory and incoherent?
Finding cracks in the way we understand the world.
I think there is a crisis of values.
Realism has failed.
We debate the way forward with today's leading thinkers.
We're all trying to understand what the hell is going on.
A live podcast production from the Institute of Art and Ideas.
Mindfulness just seems like another fad, but it actually has its roots in ancient Buddhism. Today, Stephen Batchelor, author of After Buddhism, explores the ideas and philosophy behind Buddhism, including its influence on Western society.
It's wonderful to be here. I'm going to be talking about this book, After Buddhism, which I am shamelessly promoting here. But rather than do anything boring like reading from it, I'd like to somehow just reflect on why I've written it and how it fits into my work over the last 40 years of studying, practicing, and basically trying to figure out what the hell Buddhism is. What I've noticed more and more in this period of time is that Buddhism is somehow seeping into our culture. And in fact, it's been doing this in fits and starts now for nearly 200 years, before which the West knew absolutely zero about Buddhism. And we didn't even have a word for it. The word Buddhism is an invention of Western scholars. There is no equivalent in the classical languages. We see mindfulness pretty much in every sphere of modern life today. This has all erupted in about the last 10 or 15 years. And I find this quite extraordinary, really, how this practice has found its way into completely non-Buddhist settings. We find it now being taught in the House of Commons, the House of Lords. 160 MPs and Lords have done 8-week mindfulness courses in the Houses of Parliament. Now, if you had told me that, let's say, when I was in India in the 1970s, that in 40 years' time, British parliamentarians would be sitting in meditation doing mindfulness. You could get mindfulness prescribed on the NHS. I would have written them off as fantasists. But that has come to pass. Even the title of this festival, How the Light Gets In, has for me always had a Buddhist resonance. It comes from Leonard Cohen's song Anthem. And it says, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. Now, Leonard Cohen, as probably most of you know, is a Buddhist, a Zen Buddhist, famously spent about 5 or 6 years living in a monastery during the 1990s. And many of his lyrics have implicit or sometimes quite explicit Buddhistic references. There's a crack in everything, to me suggests, the truth of life being somehow fragile and broken, distressed, suffering. And it's through attending to that that the light gets in. And in Buddhism, of course, this would be the idea of enlightenment. Enlightenment is somehow triggered by our willingness to consider what is broken and cracked and suffering and tragic. Even there, and again, that may not be what Leonard Cohen intended, but nonetheless, it fits that kind of reading quite well. But although we find in our contemporary culture there is a considerable attraction, interest, fascination with things Buddhist, be that the Dalai Lama being on TV, be that a mindfulness course being run down the road. There's also another side to Buddhism, which is that it comes across as another religion. And it would be foolish to say that Buddhism is not a religion. If you were to take a plane and fly to Bangkok or to Tokyo or somewhere and go to a Buddhist place, you will see everything that you associate with religion. You've got temples, you've got icons, you've got priests, you've got holy books, you've got incense, you've got bells being rung and chanting and monks bowing. It's all totally religious. And it would be crazy to say Buddhism isn't a religion, because the evidence clearly shows that it's a religion in spades, in many ways. And that's how it functions in most Asian societies. It has the same function in those places as Christianity has in our culture. In other words, it provides a certain solace. It provides rituals, particularly around death and so on. It provides, you know, all the things that religion would traditionally be expected to provide. But when we cast a more historically critical eye on the tradition, we find that it certainly didn't start out that way. And the earlier we go back to the foundational teachings of the Buddha, there's no suggestion at all that he was interested in offering rituals of consolation or erecting shrines or temples or anything like that at all. For many of us who have been involved in this for some years, there is an enormous interest in a kind of archaeology of Buddhism, suspending what appears to be the case on the surface. In other words, this excess of religiosity and dogma and priests and monks and so on, and tapping back through the textual tradition primarily to see, well, where did all this stuff come from? And when we get back to as close as we can to the source, what begins to be quite striking is that we recover something much more akin to a practical philosophy. And I'm using the word philosophy here, not in the sense that we might hear it being taught in a university department, but philosophy as was understood by the Greeks, who in many, many ways were doing something very, very similar to what the Buddha was doing around the same time. And there were, in fact, meetings. We know this. We know that from the Greek records, there's a strong possibility that Democritus went to India and studied there, and he would have done so effectively at the time the Buddha lived. We know about Pyrrho, the founder of skepticism, who accompanied Alexander to India and also studied with what they call gymnosophists, naked sages, which is just basically a generic term for Indian thinkers, monks, priests, wanderers, and so on. So when you strip back the more contemporary religious overlay of Buddhism, you get back to something called the Dharma. And the Dharma is very much a practice. It's something you do. It does have within it, I think, a fairly sophisticated critical apparatus of thought. It has a contemplative tradition, which is where we get mindfulness and so on. And of course, it has a very strong emphasis on ethics. And so in many ways, the Dharma is akin or very close to what the Greeks would have called philosophy. Just as the Greeks thought of the philosopher as a healer and the student of philosophy as someone who went in search of some kind of healing or cure for the soul, the Buddha too presents himself quite explicitly as a doctor, as a healer. The Dharma he speaks of as a form of therapy or medicine. And the community are basically those who assist each other in their own healing, if you wish. So it's here, too, we find resonances with the ways in which mindfulness is being used in our societies today. Many of us will have come across it now in the context of healthcare. It's shown to be quite effective in terms of combating relapses into depression, anxiety, also just in terms of dealing with pain management and so on and so forth. And of course, in the totally secular setting of modern healthcare, any Buddhist associations are, of course, completely absent. NHS didn't adopt mindfulness because they were Buddhists. They adopted mindfulness because it's been shown to work. And there are two points here I think we need to bear in mind. First of all, the Dharma needs to be evaluated, not in terms of whether what it says is true or false, that's another question, but in terms of whether it actually has a healing effect, if it actually makes a difference to the quality of your life. That's the main point. The second point is that mindfulness is not some marginal practice that went on in a few monasteries in Outer Mongolia and then got discovered and then turned into a therapeutic intervention. Mindfulness lies right at the heart of what the Buddha taught. And in fact, in one of the most famous primary texts that we find in the Pali Canon, it opens with the phrase, mindfulness is the only way to nirvana. Now, again, you've probably got all sorts of ideas as to what nirvana is. Put those out of your mind. I would argue that when you do mindfulness practice in healthcare or whatever context you do, you are in fact opening your attention, your consciousness to the possibility of dwelling in the world in another way, in a way that's not determined by habitual patterns of self-centered reactivity, whether that's attachment or fear or hatred or whatever it might be. You settle into a still, clear, open space. And that still, clear, open space is nirvana. Nirvana is here. Nirvana is right at the heart of what you're experiencing in this moment. Trouble is it gets constantly overwhelmed by thoughts and fears and fantasies and plans and busyness and so forth and so on. Mindfulness is about cultivating and opening up that space, not as an end in itself, to sort of feel nice and spaced out and chilled and cool, but in order to cultivate another perspective from which to live and to lead your life in relationships, in the world, at work, and so on and so forth. So mindfulness is a totally central thing. Now, I can't think of any other religion in which you could take a central practice and turn it into a totally secular discipline that can then be subjected to clinical trials and be shown to be effective in some way, irrespective of whether you adhere to that religion or not. And this, I think, seriously questions whether at heart what the Buddha taught is a religion. I would argue that we need to return to its core sense of being a practical philosophy, and in this way working towards what we're now beginning to call secular Buddhism. In other words, a practice in which one is completely committed to seeking to lead your life according to a set of values, engaging in certain disciplines, exploring certain ideas that have got nothing whatsoever to do with holding any religious beliefs or belonging to any form of religious institution. And this, I think, brings us also to another rather central idea, and that is the notion of the practitioner. If you've ever hung around with Buddhists, they'll sometimes say to you, I've got to go and do my practice, in a often a slightly precious way. And then they will disappear to their bedroom and they'll sit on a cushion and they'll light a stick of incense and they'll do whatever they do, and that's their practice. Now, I'm being slightly facetious here. But the point is that this Dharma, what the Buddha taught, is not something that we're asked to believe. It's something that we're invited to do. And if in doing it that leads to a certain qualitative change in a positive way in who you are and how you live, then that's, in a sense, what it's all about. So we become practicing humans. Now, this idea has been picked up recently in certain elements of contemporary philosophy towards the end of his life, Michel Foucault wrote about le gouvernance de soi, le souci de soi, the governance of self, concern for the self. And then he also talked in a famous essay about technologies of the self. And he was quite explicitly going back to the Hellenistic philosophers again. I'm not aware that he had any interest or knowledge of Buddhism. But nonetheless, he sought to restore the sense of philosophy as a practice, something that you do that makes a palpable change in how you live. And that leads necessarily into ethics. What matters is not what you believe or even what you might experience in some quasi-mystical state of enlightenment, but what really matters is, does that provide you with a framework in which to live? And that framework in Buddhism is traditionally called the Eightfold Path, which has to do with the way we see ourselves in the world, the way we make choices, the way we speak, the way we act, the way we work, all of these things. The entire range of our humanity becomes something that we consciously and deliberately seek to practice. And this was also, for the Greeks, implicit in the word askesis, from where we get the word asceticism, which of course has got a very negative ring in our culture. In fact, it's interesting how so many of the Hellenistic ideas have become somehow banalized and trivialized. Stoic, Epicurean, cynical, skeptical, ascetic. They've all got a sort of negative-ish kind of ring, and yet they all go back to forms of philosophy which had in common the idea of engaging in a practice, that the purpose of philosophy was to achieve eudaimonia, human flourishing or well-being. For Democritus, for Epicurus, for Pyrrho, it was about experiencing ataraxia, a kind of trouble-free state of mind, inner peace. Very, very similar to how I just described nirvana. My own sense, in fact, is that by tapping back into the roots of Buddhism, we return to the same kind of thought world as we find amongst the Hellenist philosophers in about the 4th century BC. So to me, that's quite exciting. There seems to be a convergence here, not only between mindfulness and therapy and so on, but also, more importantly, into the roots of our own philosophical traditions. So that's been a very roundabout way for not talking about my book. But I think it does set a frame. I wrote this book in many ways for people who are drawn, say, to the practice of mindfulness, but who are seeking something more. And I spend much of my time teaching meditation retreats in different parts of the world, and a significant number of people on these retreats today have come not because they're interested in Buddhism, but because they have had some experience through the practice of mindfulness that has led them to ask questions about who they are, about what their life is about. And there's a whole wave now into the Buddhist world of people seeking something more, and that more I would describe as a philosophical and ethical framework within which the practice of mindfulness can be integrated and situated. And this book, in many ways, is written for people like that. It's an attempt to strip away the religiosity of Buddhism, to strip away its metaphysical religious beliefs like reincarnation and karma and all of these things, and to recover its secular soul, if one could say such a strange thing. But also in the book, I not only try to articulate what such a secular Buddhism might look like and how it might be understood today, but at the same time, I seek to recover a much more human sense of the person Gautama, we know as the Buddha, rather than this rather idealized, divinized person that we are familiar with from Buddhist images and temples and so on. But who is the human being? Who is the man? What can we reconstruct about this person's life, his personality, what he was seeking to do? And again, going back to early sources, we do, I think, still have the possibility of finding the human Buddha. And this, I think, meshes very neatly with our recovery of a more secular Dharma. So why I call this book After Buddhism is because in some ways I think where we're going is going to leave what we commonly think of as Buddhism as a religion somewhat behind. And what that might open up, well, we don't know. But the way in which something new might emerge will only occur through people who commit themselves to these practices and these ideas and this ethic, and how that then plays out in their individual and their communal and their social worlds.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast brought to you by the Institute of Art and Ideas. Let us know what you thought by tweeting at @IAI_TV with the hashtag #AfterBuddhism. If you enjoyed this talk, check out The Weird and the Wonderful, which you can watch on the IAI TV player. For more episodes, subscribe to the Philosophy for Our Times podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud or Stitcher for more big ideas on the go. We always love to hear feedback, so please email us on podcast@IAI.tv.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.